Live from beyond the Beltway, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, political servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, who has spent most of his life in the juvenile justice system as a guard. Jason Hill, author of a new book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? And also, we'll be joined by community activist Willie Preston from Chicago's West Side. And thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. Our program tonight coming to you from the studios of WCGO in beautiful Evanston, Illinois. Nice to have you with us. Obviously, the world of politics today is focused on Orlando, Florida, where Donald Trump made his first speech since leaving the White House. And again, throughout the broadcast, actually in the second hour primarily of our broadcast this evening, we're going to be talking about that and some of the things that he had to say. We'll also have a live report from Orlando from Stephanie Tressel, who is a well-known and regarded talk show host here in the Chicagoland area. She is at CPAC, and she's going to be joining us during that portion of the show. That will start in our second hour this evening. But this evening, we're going to begin with a new book that came across my desk. And again, today is the last day of Black History Month, so this will be our contribution to the discussion. And we will be talking about a variety of things related to race relations in the United States. But I want to welcome Jason Hill. He is author of that new book. It's called What Do White Americans Owe Black People? And again, Jason is a regarded professor at DePaul University. So, Jason, welcome to Beyond the Beltway, or welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. What was your goal in writing the book?
I didn't hear that question, Bruce. Could you repeat the question?
I think he asked, what was your goal in writing the book?
Oh, what was my goal in writing the book? The goal in writing the book was because recently there's been a lot of conversation about reparations that has been reiterated by people like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Ibram Kendi. And I wanted to take these reparations argument very seriously. And I know that the Black community has been divided on this question of reparations is something due by the government to Blacks. And I wanted to take the claims very seriously and to address them in the book. And this is what I do. And I happen to be one of those persons who think that Blacks are not owed reparations by the state. And what I do in the book is go back to the very founding of America from 1776 to show that although Blacks were excluded from the pantheon of freedom, that the foundations for freedom were forged in 1776. But I focus mainly on the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the affirmative action programs, President Johnson's War on Poverty and the Great Initiatives.
Let me ask our other guests. I'll start with you, Willie. Willie, what is your answer to the question? White Americans, so what do they owe Black people, if anything?
I wouldn't put it squarely on white Americans. So I think the appropriate question is, what is the American government owe this country? Mm-hmm. And I think the American government owes this country reparations for African Americans. Mm-hmm. And to your guest here, I just want to push back a little bit on what he just said. He said he knows the Black community is divided on reparations, and I can't agree with that. I think the Black community, by and large, is pro reparations for our people. I think what we're divided is if we believe the government is capable of redressing its sin of slavery through a reparations bill. And some people think it's not capable. I happen to believe we are capable.
Okay. Let's go. Anthony Anderson, what's your answer to the question?
Well, I agree with the professor on this issue. The fact of the matter is no white person today had anything to do with slavery, and no white person today even owned slaves. And so I don't want to put this issue on the backs of individuals who had really nothing to do with it. If there are some issues with slavery and someone thinks that they're owed reparations, then you go directly to that source. Otherwise, it's wholly unfair to think that Americans, white Americans today, should be on the hook for some issues that happened, you know, so early on in this nation's history.
Let's go back to Willie. Willie, follow up on that, because I would say that that's the thing that I hear most frequently when the subject comes up, is that, you know, people alive today, they were not involved in any of the things that at least set a foundation for inequality that you suggest.
So I would follow that up by very quickly saying, listen, in this country, we do believe in we believe in passing down all the treasures through our family members, correct? If my grandfather were to leave a home, my father were to leave a home to me today, I could receive that home by birthright, because I can inherit his property. And just the same with his bills, I would have to be responsible for all of his, you know, his bills. And I think the same thing is true. It's true that no one alive, we all know, was either a slave or a slave owner. But the reality is there's no question that Black Americans, African Americans, descendants of slaves, ADOs, we were harmed disproportionately. We were directly harmed through slavery, and that there were white Americans and others who directly benefited from slavery. So that's what reparations is called. It's a repair for a harm that was done. Jason, and we still suffer from that repair. All of us on this panel do. We suffer from that from that damage right now.
Let me jump in and go back to Jason and ask him to elaborate a little more and respond to your interpretation of the question and the need for reparations that you've just heard from Willie.
Well, I think the reparations was done. The right was wrong by the 1964 Civil Rights Act, where Blacks were brought full inclusion before the law. And I make the further argument that there have been reparative moments in affirmative action, in Black Studies programs, in President Johnson's initiative acts, where billions of dollars were dispensed to Blacks in the form of welfare programs, that there have been reparative moments. And second, since the 1972 Employment Act, any damages that have been, any form of discrimination inflicted on Blacks belong in courts of law, not in reparations claims.
You know, I would like to add also, Bruce, that I think it's wholly impossible to say with definitive agreement that most Black people born after 1965 have absolutely had every right secured under the Constitution given to them. Now, prior to that, there can be some conversation, but anybody born after 1965, I'm sorry, but you have every right that was afforded to us under this Constitution.
Yeah.
When you see, and this is for everybody, also for people that are listening and watching the broadcast this evening, when you're walking down the street and you're approached by someone who needs help, in many cases, at least in urban areas, that person is Black. Not always, it's not universal, but in Chicago, it is generally a Black person asking for some help. When we come back, I want to hear from each of you how you react to that person. What do you think about, and do you do anything about it? 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
For some, news is about their opinions. We believe the news should give you the facts without bias, so you can form your own. We believe in news, not talk. Facts, not opinions. News Nation is on every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America to give you the information you need. Everyone calls it the news, but we'll actually deliver on it 7 nights a week in primetime. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. News Nation. It's your news, your nation.
The tween made you see.
We are the boy.
It's painful concert number 3.
We are the boy band. We're 5 and 19.
We are the boy band.
Always singing on key.
You love your kids enough to take them to see their favorite band. Love them enough to make sure they're buckled up in the back seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. We continue with Beyond the Beltway, and I want to go to Anthony Anderson to respond to the question I asked before the break. When you're walking down the street and you see a homeless person approaching you, that person that you encounter may be black, may be white. I made the point that living in the Chicagoland area, most of those that approach me are African-American. But number one, how do you feel when someone like that runs into you or you run into them? What goes through your mind?
The first thing that comes to my mind is, how was it, Bruce, in this country with all of its opportunities, how is it that anyone can find themselves in a situation such as that person? Now, that's one side of me. The other side also says, you have people, millions of people on a yearly basis are risking their lives and their families' lives to come over to this country because it's the land of opportunity. So how is it that someone that's native to this country can't see that? It's beyond me. Secondly, when you brought up the issue, I was in the car with my daughter just a couple of weeks ago, and we were going down, you know, one of the streets there. And the thing was, a homeless person, you know, when you're making those turns and getting onto the expressways or getting onto the streets, they walk up to my car. And immediately what my daughter did was she started rolling up her window. I'm like, what's wrong? What do you roll up the windows for? Because there's somebody right there. I said, listen, he wants some money. He's homeless. So she immediately rolled down the window. I gave her some money to give to the individual. I honestly feel a sense of, you know, humanity when it comes to those individuals. But again, I find myself in a situation wondering, how is it that somebody can make a decision, a rational decision, when you can wake up and be whoever you want to be in this country, and it can happen. All it takes is your pure will. It's a sense of, you know, people just have to know where they're at and what's going on.
Do you follow-up question to you? When you see someone like that, do you more than often give them some money, or is that rare?
I'm sorry, Bruce, what did you say?
I say, when you see someone in that condition, you said in your story, you said that you gave them some money. Do you normally give someone money if they ask you for it?
Yes, all the time. I mean, I always have money on them, so it's not a problem.
Willie Preston, I want to go to you and get your same reaction when you run into someone on the street that may be approaching you for some money.
You know, when I was younger, I would give to any and everybody who asked when I had it.
Yeah.
Now I'm more subjective about it because I think really where my focus is, and I think where most folks' focus should be, is changing the conditions where people end up in there so frequently. And you're right. And it doesn't make me feel well. But in the city that we live in Chicago, this is generally in my experience coming from my people. But that is not just. It is not. I don't look at this as an individual who just made poor decisions or someone who just is blind to opportunity. I recognize that there are tons of people who were structurally conditioned to be poor, and I actually see it happening right now, repeating itself. Right now, where we see Chicago school children who are not able to be afforded the world class education that the city of Chicago is capable of providing. When we see that certain children in certain communities still to this day have a greater quality of education.
Willie, in your case, do you also think that there are government programs that exist that you pay for through your tax dollars that this person could utilize? I mean, there is a place where they could go to get shelter over their head if they wanted to, but a lot of times they don't want to go there because maybe there's a religious requirement. Do you think about that person, although they look like they're destitute with no friend in the world, that the reality is that because of government programs, there are some people that could help them at that moment in their life?
Absolutely. What I'll say is there are a ton of things that we can do immediately. And one of the things that we can do, even if you don't take the case necessarily of the homeless person, right, but you take the case of people that are poor, people that are working for, you could easily, people that are on programs, federal programs such as Section 8, they could easily be, we could turn those vouchers that they use to pay someone rent and make them homeowners. You know, the number one thing that you can get in this country, supposedly the American dream, is to be a homeowner. And I can tell you as myself, my wife and I, we bought our first home a couple of years ago. It was the proudest day of my life. To open the door and allow my children to walk in and say, this is home. And you know what? It's a different mentality. You want to clean up in front of your home. You want to take care of your community. You take more ownership in it. That's a program right now that we could stand up in Chicago. Why are we allowing the government to give people housing vouchers so that they can give someone else money every month, and they take no pride in that property. They take no pride in that community. If we change that, allow those folks to use those vouchers to become homeowners with other stipulations that make sure that they go out and work. That's a program we could change communities right now for poor people.
I want to go back to Professor Hill and let you weigh in on the question that I asked before the break, Professor, and that is, when you see a homeless person that may approach you on the street, what goes through your mind, and do you help, do you not help? What's the criteria that you use when you're personally approached?
Well, I'm a very religious person. I'm a humanistic person. So I always, just out of a sense of compassion and empathy, I have to give. But Bruce, my first question is, what are the structural conditions that has given rise to this? And I think that this country has systematically emasculated Black men, first of all, by disincentivizing them from taking care of their families, going back to the 60s, by disincentivizing Black women from taking care of their own children by the state offering itself as a surrogate husband to Black women, marrying themselves to the state, and breaking up the family, right? Disencouraging marriage. The marriage rate between Blacks and whites were out of birth wedlock was 22% before the 1960s, up until 1960. After 1965, and today, the out-of-birth wedlock among African-Americans is 70%, and 70% of those kids are born into poverty. So I think there's a great deal of the Black man has been emasculated by the state because he wants to take care of his children, but going back to the 1960s, horrible programs where Black women were offered as surrogate brides to the state. Good Black men were disincentivized from taking care of their children, and the breakup of communities fostered by the state. The state has never been the friend of the Black community. It's been the enemy since day one.
I want to go to elaborate on that. Go ahead.
And just to speak to what the professor said, he's absolutely correct. You know, I'm a product of Chicago. I grew up, most people know that I grew up in the Chicago Housing Authority. I grew up in the Henry Horner Projects, which used to be right across the street from the United, which is the United Center now, before it was the Chicago Stadium. And I saw firsthand that if you were a Black woman and you lived in the projects, if you had a male living at home, the first thing they would do is they would take away your benefits. And that way they were disincentivizing two-parent families. And so the professor is absolutely correct. I saw that with my own eyes firsthand.
Why has it taken so long for government to react to that, Willie, if you agree with that? Do you agree with Anthony's comment?
I'm sorry. So, yeah, I do agree with it, actually. And I think that one of the reality is that government is run by humans, and humans are flawed, you know, and that is just the reality of it. I think that it has been fundamentally it's been a problem for African Americans in terms we haven't acted savvy enough politically.
How do you break the cycle that Anthony just talked about?
Well, it's quite simple, actually. You go ahead and you focus on business, and you stop. To be frank with you, we have to stop giving away so many entitlement programs. We have to stop that. We have to incentivize business. We have to incentivize work. But that doesn't change the fact that reparations is still a policy that this country needs to put
What do the leaders in the Black community need to do? Anthony, I'll start with you.
Well, Bruce, here's the problem. Just this week, the University of Chicago had a study in which Chicago was named the most corrupt city in the United States of America.
I thought they were third. I thought they were third.
No, they were third in terms of the state of Illinois was third. Oh, the city of Chicago was number one. The number one corrupt city in this country was Chicago. The number three corrupt state in this country was Illinois, right behind New York and right behind California. And so if you look at it, you have to look at the policies. It is the policies that the Blacks have adhered to over the years, over the decades, that have gotten us into the situation that we're in today. If Black people continue to adhere to the same policies that we've adhered to over the decades and over the years, then we're going to keep on having these same problems, irregardless of which politician is in office. Black people have way too much compassion for politicians. Black people have put way too much trust into Black leadership in general. And it's sad to say, but that most Blacks have, to the detriment of the Black community, did a lot of things that really don't quite really make sense for Black people. And for whatever reason, they continue to vote the same thing in office. Jason, and I'm not saying that they're, you know,
Jason Hill, do you agree?
But the problem is they have been misled in terms of policy.
Okay.
Policy has gotten us to this position, and policy will get us out of this position.
I want to get Jason and Willie to respond to that. Jason, you first.
I agree. I think that these black leaders are racial pimps, hucksters, and exploiters of Black people. I think Black community members, from mothers to church leaders and church and community organizers, need to take control of their communities. You know, they know where the gang. We haven't even talked about the crime rates and the Black on Black crime that is the biggest genocide of the Black communities. It's not white cops that are going into these Black, or white people from the suburbs going and massacring Black people. It's other Black people killing Black people. And Blacks in their own communities know who these gang members are. And it will take vigilance, and it will take community leaders and church leaders, and not politicians who don't give a hoot about Black people. All they care about is a voting block and coming in with some Kentucky Fried Chicken every 4 years. And, you know, so with some sauce and some watermelon, like Hillary Clinton did.
I want to come back to that. We do have to break. I want Willie Preston to pick up on that, because he is an activist on the west side of Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
Opinions are everywhere when you watch the news. But what about your opinion? Why can't you just get the facts to decide for yourself? News Nation is on every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America, a nightly newscast in primetime that doesn't tell you what to think. 7 nights a week, News Nation will deliver you news, not talk. Facts, not opinions. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. It's your news, your nation.
Hope you enjoyed your meal. And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? Caring for my brother is far from easy. But he's a part of me, like my arms and legs, so I'll be his. No time for tired. Nothing can disable this love. He needs me, but I'm the lucky one, even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. And at this point of the broadcast, we let each of our guests take a moment to introduce themselves. And we're going to begin with Jason Hill. Jason, tell us a little bit about your background and what we're talking about here tonight.
I'm Jason Hill. I'm happy to be here with you again, Bruce. I was born and raised in Jamaica, came to America when I was 20 years old to become a novelist, and then ended up getting a PhD in philosophy and becoming a professor and writing a lot of books. My latest book is What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Depression. Uh-huh. And I write a lot on politics and American foreign policy and ethics, and also do a lot of work in human rights and some policy work also. So I do a lot of political commentary.
When you're in obviously, you're coming from an academic, a professorial position. Are other professors around the country, do they respond when you write a book? Do they jump up and either agree or disagree with it? What sort of reaction do you get from within the academic community when you write a book, especially one with somewhat of a controversial title, like What Do White Americans Owe Black People?
Well, I'm a complete outlier in the academic community. I mean, I wrote my three first academic books that got me tenure and professor. And I realized, and I'm also a journalist, I write a column for different magazines. And then I wrote two commercial books after that, one called We Have Overcome, an Immigrant's Letter to the American People. So, and I describe myself as an independent conservative. You know, I have traditionally voted for the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. but I'm a conservative independent, and which means I'm owned by no one. My colleagues consider me a complete outlier. Most of them don't speak to me.
Really?
Because because I don't adhere to the kind of left-wing, radical, crazy orthodoxy that's espoused in universities today. I'm not a Marxist. I'm not a communist. I believe I'm a great.
So if you walk into the faculty lounge at DePaul University, and you're either going to have a bite to eat or you want to just sit and relax for a while, there isn't anybody that's going to come up and engage you in conversation?
No, they probably look the other way, because I'm also very pro-Israel, and I'm pro-America, and I'm pro-capitalism. And, you know, I think, unlike a lot of my colleagues who are liberals, who are part of a managerial class, who think that I believe in Black people, by the way, and I think that Black people are an incredible race of people who, through slavery, have managed to, through their own agency, have made tremendous sacrifices and have uplifted themselves. They're part of a managerial class, liberal class, who think that Blacks don't have, who want to expropriate the agency of Black people and want to take care of them. And I think, I say, the best thing you can do to Black people is leave them alone, get out of their way. They can take care of themselves. They don't need a liberal class to take care of them, to take care of them. They have been taking them care of themselves since they arrived on slave ships. And they don't like to hear this. And they like a victim narrative. And I don't believe Blacks are victims of anything. I think they've been victimized, but I don't think they're victims. And so, you know, a liberal class don't like to hear this. And when I coming from Jamaica 20, I didn't have a victim story. And when you believe in the agency of a race that you represent, and you tell people that Blacks have all the capabilities to uplift themselves, and you point to, for example, they don't, you know, the entrepreneurs and the Black owned businesses and hotels and private schools that Blacks ran during segregation and after emancipation and were successful thrivers, they discount this narrative. So I'm very much of an outlier.
Okay. In the world. Let's go to Anthony Anderson. Anthony, you've been on this program for several times over the last, I would say, probably 5 or 7 years. Tell everybody a little bit about your background. You referenced where you come from, but elaborate on that and how you got to the Marine Corps and how you got here tonight.
Sure. I grew up in Chicago. Chicago's been my hometown for the last 50 years or so. I'm 50 years old, actually, but I've been in Chicago. I was a Marine Corps veteran, veteran of Operation Desert Storm, Desert Shield. I've a state employee. I've worked in several correctional facilities, Danville Correctional Center. I've worked at Joliet Correctional Center. Valley View Correctional, mm-hmm. and just recently Warrenville Correctional Center is where I recently retired from. Mm-hmm. And I was with the state for 27 years before I retired, last year in August. So I've been around, for some time now. And, it's really sad to see, Bruce, how far we have not come in terms of Blacks and understanding and policy in Chicago. It really is, even though, if you look at the leadership in Chicago is mostly Black, you cannot, if a person were to look at it now, they wouldn't can understand why are things the way they are. And if you look back into the 80s when I was around, even when Harold Washington was the mayor, back when I was growing up, you know, when you had the wars with the aldermen and all that stuff, and you didn't realize that they were all in the same party.
Right.
And now they're all in the same party, and it seems like we still haven't gotten anywhere. And so, you know, I've been around a long time. I've been around politics forever, and I've been a Republican, it seems like, all my life. So
what have you observed over the last 25 years that you just described?
Yes.
What difference have you seen, if any, in the type of person that is incarcerated that you have had to guard? I mean, are they more violent? Are they more disturbed? Are things getting better? Is there any positive
sign
you see?
Nowadays, you see, especially within the youth and the juvenile system, a lot of those individuals, 90% of them didn't come from a two-parent household, one, and even more didn't come from even having parents. I mean, it's just the fact of the matter. That parents that cared at least for their livelihood.
Did you come from a two parent household?
No, one parent household. But it was the understanding, you know, when my mother told me, you know, I'm going to hit you so hard, God is going to get the news late. You know, my first question was, well, how's that happening? I mean, if I'm praying and you praying, how is he going to get the news before I get the news? So, you know, that's what I grew up under. You know, it was the rod. You spared a rod, you spoiled a child. You know, if DCFS was around during the days that I was growing up, it would be a totally different story. But those are things that made me who I am today. You know, I have no regrets. I love my parents, and, you know, it is what it was. And so it made me who I am today. And I am forever grateful for it. In addition to being in a country that really, you really can't wake up tomorrow and be whoever you want to be. And so yes, I was always of the mindset, I am going to grow up and be whoever I want to be in regards to what the conditions and what the circumstances are. And I wasn't born in, you know, with their two-parent family. I wasn't born. I didn't know we were poor until I grew up, as a matter of fact. But we still had sense. The one thing you do not do is go out there and act as though, you know, you don't act under authority. And that's what we're missing today, sadly. We have youth and individuals out there not respecting authority. And that's the biggest problem that we face, I believe, in our community.
I want to go to Willie. Willie, tell us a little bit about who you are. We should mention, by the way, because we're open and honest around here. You and I are Facebook friends, and we really have never met face-to-face, but I've always been impressed by your posts and your reaction and a little bit about your background, because you're very involved in the school situation in Chicago. You're on television quite a bit when things are screwed up in the public school system, which is just about all the time.
So let me make one important correction. I hail from the great South Side of Chicago.
South Side, I'm sorry.
Let's start there. I was born in Inglewood and raised primarily there. With my mother and father, they were married, but they split when I was a child. But both of them remained active in my life. I was either with one or the other, my brothers and I, or myself.
I stand corrected.
I am married to my wonderful wife, Brittany Preston. Shout out to Brittany Preston. And we've shared 6 children together. We have kids ranging from our 16-year-old to a 4-year-old. And so that's my high school sweetheart. And we have been, you know, traveling this road of being involved in our community ever since we first put our children in early childcare to now where we have a high schooler. So that's why I stay involved, you know, for the most part at this point in what's affecting Chicago's children, because that's my life.
I'm raising children
with my wife right now. And I do agree with some of what the gentlemen are saying. I think that there's a disturbing trend politically in Chicago. It's a historical problem in our community. And I think that's rooted in machine politics, where Black folks have essentially had apparent representation that looks like us, but they haven't really held autonomy. They haven't really been able to speak for the true interest for our community, because in Chicago, politically, you come from a town where a politician told me nobody wants you unless someone sent you. Yep. And essentially what that means is no one has real leadership, hasn't been allowed to rise up in Chicago. It's been staunchly forbidden for folks to come up who actually want to serve their community. It's a very close party, and our people primarily haven't been able to even enjoy independent leadership, because especially in my day and age, I'm 36, you know, folks, myself, I'm a former candidate for state representative. When you run for public office in this city, in Chicago, in Cook County, you're talking about a local race. They'll raise $500,000 to stop you, which is what happened to me. And so when you have the influx of money under the auspice of Mike Madigan and a few folks inside the local Democratic Party, you will rarely see someone who actually is risen from our community, who can relate to their neighbors and go down to, you know, our state capitol or the city council, quite frank, and say, no, I can't go for this because this will harm Ms. Johnson, my neighbor. This will harm little Michael, my neighbor down the street here.
I got to interrupt here, Willie, because we're going to go to a break. When we come back, you referenced Anthony, the loss, you know, when your father wasn't in your house. And that's a story we hear a lot within the Black community. My question is there anything that can be done, or who within the community can rise up and take on the role of a father in Black family?
You should form your own opinions when you're presented facts without bias. That's what we call news. Every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America, news has a new primetime home. News Nation. Without all the talk and without an opinion, so you can make yours. It's not how it used to be. It's how it should be. News Nation. 7 nights a week on WGN America. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. Because it's your news, your nation.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Ugh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. I asked the question before the break. If what we've heard from Anthony is accurate, and I think most people listening to the program have probably heard that there has been an exodus from the black family of men for many, many years, somewhat of a systemic problem that Anthony has talked about regarding the government and incentives for women and men to act in the ways that they acted in the 50s and 60s and beyond because of government incentives. But my question to you is, who has replaced the father? And is there anyone in society, whether it's a clergyman, is it an athlete, is there anyone that has been successful in filling the role of a father? And we're going to start with you, Anthony, because you said you grew up in a home that did not have a father.
Right. I think, Bruce, unfortunately, for Black America, for the most part, what has replaced Black men in the Black family has been gangster rap, has been the entertainment industry, has been everything but a male figure in that person's life. And so, and not to mention the fact that the street gangs have taken over tremendously in the Black community. And so that's what has taken the place of the Black man in the Black family.
Can you hang on, now, hang on just 1 second? I want to get the reaction just to that from our other guests. Jason Hill, weigh in on your thoughts on that, and then we'll go to Willie.
I think he's absolutely right. First of all, I think that, you know, masculinity is just under assault in this country. And men, it's hard to be a man in this country today because I think the feminist movement has just gone, and especially the hashtag MeToo movement, that insidious movement, has gone way too far in waging a war against men. And I think Anthony is perfectly right that the search for a father figure has gone into a nefarious register that is gangster and gang members. So I think what has to be restored is a healthy appreciation for masculinity and for the authoritarian, in the best sense of the word, male figure. And this kind of division, this kind of egalitarianism that is being spread by progressivism, I think is a bunch of malarkey. And just very, very quickly, the second thing that I want to say is that you know, as someone who used to be a radical atheist and is now very, very religious, I think that we're all children under God. And this notion that, you know, it's only Black men that can provide mentorship for children is also a bunch of malarkey. I would say that get rid of promote charter schools and give tax vouchers to Black parents and tax breaks for education. Get kids in the private schools where they can get proper mentorship from male role models, because they're not going to get it in the public schools.
I want to go to Willie. I want to go to Willie to react to the question about whether he agrees with Anthony's assessment of the role of a gangster and gangster rap as replacing fathers and masculinity in a Black home.
Oh, I absolutely agree. In the cases where the father has been completely absent, yes. My father was never completely absent. He was always present. And so even as I tried to allow my idols to be gangster rappers or gangbangers, he wouldn't allow it. And so I think it's absolutely crucial that we keep Black men inside the house. That's why I'm dedicated to being a father to my children, my nieces, my nephews, when their fathers weren't always able to be present, and community members and children now who lack a father for whatever reason. But let me say something. I analyze this different than I think my co-panelist tonight. You have street gangs, as you cited, and rappers as they look too. But the two things that children see in those two folks are success. And this is why we do have to refocus as a community. And yes, the government has a role to play, as making certain that Black men are in a position to be successful. That's why we need to focus on trade schools inside of our, we start with the children today who will be men tomorrow. We need trade schools in our high school. Hell, we can have them in our grammar schools. They're intelligent enough. We need junior first responders inside of our communities. Why is it that our community is so against being the cop? It's because they don't have people who care about them, who respect them, more importantly, in uniform enough inside of their own communities. We need term limits in order to achieve any of these things, since we want to talk about policy. We need term limits. There's no way that someone can amass as much power as the former Speaker Mike Madigan, but to have been in power for 50 years.
Do we need something? Because in the last segment, you talked about the difference in unwed mothers and families without marriage. And you know, and marriage exists in some Black homes; it doesn't exist in others. Is that something that the Black community should strive for? And how aggressive absolutely. Have the ministers been?
To that point, Bruce, you know, if based on what the professor said earlier, which he was absolutely right in his assertion, that it was the government who tore down the Black family in the early to late 60s.
Yeah.
It should be the government to incentivize marriage within the Black community now to repair what was done back in the 60s. Because everybody knows an intact family is the best thing for kids growing up in today's age. Now, whether or not they'll make the right decisions, who knows? But the fact of the matter is, their decisions will get better over time, especially with the two-parent household. And so government needs to incentivize marriage within the Black community, just as they disincentivized marriage in the Black community in the early 60s.
That is a controversial comment, and one that I would suspect might get some phone call reaction. So we're going to pick up on that in the second hour of the broadcast this evening. We should also mention the big political story is Donald Trump's speech in Orlando at CPAC today. And when we come back, we're going to be switching gears for a little bit. We're going to be talking about that. Our guests who are currently here, they'll be weighing in on that as well. And we'll also be joined by Stephanie Tressel, veteran talk show host here in the city of Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Don't go away. Another full hour of Beyond the Beltway is coming up right here. Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Hour number two continues. And we're going to be back with our guests, Willie Preston and Anthony Anderson and Jason Hill. They'll join us in about 15 minutes, and we'll be back to our conversation. But again, the big news is that CPAC met in Orlando, Florida today, and this afternoon President Trump was there. So was thousands of conservatives, including Stephanie Tressel, who's one of the best conservative talk show hosts in the country. And Stephanie, nice to have you with us back on Beyond the Beltway.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. You're much too kind. I'm just so excited that I can bring a little bit of man on the street kind of reporting right here from beautiful Orlando.
What was the general, first of all, before we talk too much about what happened or what the President Trump had to say today, was there anyone else on the conservative agenda down there that got a very large round of applause or sort of impressed people in any way?
Well, the usual Jim Jordan and Ted Cruz types and people just being very inspirational. I mean, we're all in a weird space right now as a result of such a brutal election cycle and between us being labeled kind of conspiracy theorists and everybody kind of gave up and said, okay, let's just accept the election. So it was so great to hear people, like-minded people. This is a safe space for conservatives. Me being from Illinois, there are not a lot of places where I can proudly support my president and my party without being, you know, attacked or canceled. So this was something that I think we all needed, just to be in a space with like-minded people saying, what's our next step? And I couldn't go into the long list of amazing the speakers that we had, and one after another. What's so great is that it is on YouTube if anybody wants to know what they missed at CPAC. But it was very important for me to be in the room with Donald Trump. I was fortunate back in October. There was a Back the Blue Blexit event, and Trump spoke on the South Lawn to all of us, and it was his first time speaking after he had COVID. So to be in the room, for him to address us the first time after he left the White House, I felt doubly blessed. And even before he got there, I mean, I got here Thursday night, Trump sentiment, a lot of people wearing Trump masks, Trump gear. It it's very obvious that we still love our president, and today just sealed the deal for us. I mean, we needed to hear him, and he needed to hear our support, and just the feeling in the room. We honestly, what gets me about Trump, I mean, I think he showed, he showed Republicans how to be strong Republicans, and it seems like he's only been gone 6 weeks, and our Republican leaders are falling right back into what they do.
Yeah.
Feckless, going along to get along. And he just reminded us that, hey, I'm still in this fight. There's still more work to be done.
Did he give you did he give a list of people that he thinks should not be in the party? How much time did he spend maybe retaliation?
Yeah. Well, you know, he's still Donald Trump with being in the White House or not. Of course, he told us the people that voted to impeach him. I mean, how dare you? He reminded us that the Democrats, we may not agree with them, we may not love them, but they stick together. Not one Democrat ever spoke up against Obamacare or any of his policies. But we have these Republicans that cannot wait to jump on board to bash our president because they didn't like him in the first place, and maybe they got on board just because, you know, it was hard not to. But the moment that he's gone, they can't wait to stab him in the back. They're going right back to what they do, which is just try to secure their little position, secure their power. And they're really not there to speak for the people like Donald Trump did for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And again, what was the reaction that Governor DeSantis of Florida received?
Oh, he opened the event. Welcome to Florida. Isn't it great to be in an open state? And coming from Illinois, I certainly, I'm looking forward to that. The only thing, just to be negative, I have to say something negative about the event. I've been going to CPAC. I believe this is my sixth one.
Yeah.
And it's organized very well. It's put together. But unfortunately, we're in Orange County. And the hotel that we stayed at was very adamant about mask policies.
Okay.
So as a person that only wears masks if I absolutely have to,
mm-hmm.
and most of us, I would just say, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I think a lot of conservatives believe in our freedom. I didn't think we'd have to wear the mask once we were in the convention mm-hmm. space where it's just us. I want to respect the rest of the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only part that was kind of negative, and they just seemed to be, you know, just like they hired mass police just to almost follow us around.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it was a great venue. They had to get us out of D.C. because Florida is a state where you can actually gather X amount of people, which was nice. But, I feel just very just inspired. I feel recharged, and we know what we need to do, and that's to keep fighting. Because
am I correct, Stephanie, that you are solidly on the Trump train for another run in 2024?
Well, just keep this between me and you, Bruce.
Okay.
I'm sure no one else is listening. I'm teasing. But I love the 4 years that we had Donald Trump. But I think that his role now is to vet candidates, to fundraise, to go out there and inspire America, and doing everything that he's done for the last 5 years since he came down that escalator. Do I want him to run again? I know there's a revenge aspect to a lot of conservatives. That we need to get them back. But I don't know. If I were him, would I want to put myself through everything that they put me through? I think that we need to be looking at, okay, who's next in the party that maybe because Trump, you know, if not Trump, then who?
Mm-hmm.
But I would just like to see him just to be free and to be able to be Donald Trump without them criticizing everything. And they
mm-hmm.
would just be so laser focused on taking him out even before he got in.
Yeah.
And I just think that he's done so much for our country. I appreciate his 4 years, but I would rather just see him as a figurehead and just someone that's really inspiring people and showing mm-hmm. people how to be bold Republican.
Yeah, well, also, I mean, given his age, I mean, there should be the evolution and the development of other people within the party who I think understand that you're not going to win re-election without the Trump people, and they would argue that Donald Trump got 74 million votes, but Joe Biden got 80 million votes. So there is an issue
right.
of just basic arithmetic that has to be considered in any election, and certainly he will be a dominant figure, but it seems to me that other members of the party should be allowed to at least flourish or test their mettle, and part of that is, amassing a large crowd and amassing some money to keep them going, and that's a test of leadership as well.
Yeah, the Democrat Party, I'm surprised. It was always the party, ever since Obama came around, the youthful party. And now, 70-year-old, 80-year-old, and however old Joe is, I don't even know. He's well into his 70s.
Yeah.
What's very inspiring about CPAC, every year there are more and more young people are showing up well-dressed, coming from their colleges. And that inspires me. That's the future of the Republican Party, because Democrats start indoctrinating children in kindergarten. And here we are, brave young men and women that go to a liberal college and they come here just to be in a safe space, or they don't mind. They're bold enough to wear their elephant lapel pin when they're on their campus. And I'm inspired by the next group of young people like Charlie Kirk's group and all these people that I constantly meet. And also, as a Black woman, when I came to CPAC the first time, there were a few Blacks, but Trump made the tent so much bigger. There are more Hispanics, there are more Asian, there's more everything. Everybody wants to be in the on the Trump team, because you can say whatever you want about Trump, whether you agree with him or not, but you cannot argue with the fact that that man loves America and he wants everyone to do well. And that whole even questioning of the model of putting America first, everyone puts their family first, and that's what America is to him, his family. He wants us to do well. And then as a result, you know, we lift, you know, all boats, as they say. And he just gives everybody the inspiration that you were born here. There's nothing you can't achieve if you're just willing to work for it.
Stephanie Trussell, I thank you very much for offering your report live from Orlando, Florida, from CPAC this evening. Stephanie Trussell, a veteran talk show host here in the Chicagoland area. And Stephanie, we look forward to having you as part of our Beyond the Beltway panel in the not-too-distant future, maybe in the next few weeks. And again, thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly.
For some, news is about their opinions. We believe the news should give you the facts without bias, so you can form your own. We believe in news, not talk. Facts, not opinions. News Nation is on every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America to give you the information you need. Everyone calls it the news, but we'll actually deliver on it. Seven nights a week in prime time. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. News Nation. It's your news, your nation.
Your tween made you see.
We are the boy.
It's painful concert number three.
We are the boy band. We're 5 and 19.
We are the boy band.
Always singing on key.
You love your kids enough to take them to see their favorite band. Love them enough to make sure they're buckled up in the back seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us. Let's go to Ray, who is listening to us on the radio this evening. No, Ray is not there. I'm sorry. So we'll forget Ray. And how about Dave? Is Dave still standing by in the great state of Washington? Or is he? Let's go to line three. Ray, Dave, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me, Bruce?
Yes, and you've been waiting a long time, so we'll give you your nickel's worth. And I mentioned that our guests, Anthony Anderson, Jason Hill, and and Willie Preston are also continuing to join us this evening. So go ahead with your question.
Oh, that's great. Well, first, Semper Fi to the fellow Marine on the board.
Okay.
Because I was a Marine also, so I'm happy to see that panelist.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to mention that as far as the reparations, and first, actually, as far as you talk about single-family households and especially single, you know, women without the male figure staying in the relationship, and then you have parents, single-family parents, and how that's expanded. Well, both that and many other negatives in society, I think, are all expanding because of one thing. One is the loss of religion and people having that bond to sort of a more normality, I would say. I kind of see it as a shaming. And personal accountability. You used to have more shaming, and
right.
You know, people were ashamed if they did something that was going to kind of violate either the church or even their family, shame their family. And now, if people were trying to be shamed or held to personal accountability, that's counted as bullying and hate speech. You can't tell somebody, hey, you made a mistake, you shouldn't have done that. And I think that's kind of how we're ending up with so many, you know, children, whether they're white, black, whatever. You know, you have these kids having 4 or 5 kids when they're 22 years old. And no parent there. That's a big part of the problem we have, you know,
Dave,
in society.
Dave, I want to let our, stay on the line. I want to let our guests respond to that. That's a very good point. We'll start with Anthony Anderson. Do you agree with what Dave is talking about?
Yes, absolutely. The caller is absolutely correct. That intact family is key. The nuclear family is going to be key in order for blacks to move ahead, or any family for that matter. And so, yes, I wholeheartedly agree with this assessment that the and also the aspect of shaming. You know, not that you want to bring make any disparaging remarks about individuals, but at some point you have to feel a sense of responsibility for your actions. And having a sense of responsibility for your actions will go a long way in not only the Black community, but any community, especially in our community.
Willie Preston, your response.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I think it's right. You know, I remember even when I was a kid, you know, when I came from the streets of Inglewood, let me just be frank. And, you know, I was a kid when my parents separated. I ran towards the streets and I wanted to be the toughest gangbanger in Chicago.
Yep.
But there were certain things that I would not do in front of Miss Ivory. Why? Because we had a community and I didn't want her to be disappointed. I didn't want her to tell my grandmother. Miss Ivory was an elderly woman in my community. Mm-hmm. What we have now is a breakdown in communities. When you have a breakdown in community, regardless if it's a poor community or a wealthy community, and where there's no one that I guess you can say shame you, or that you care to disappoint, then you have free reign to do any and everything. So I think the call is right into the degree that we do have to have community where people have enough relationship built in with people where they can say, hey, man, you're messing up. You can't do that. But if we don't have stable communities, you're never going to be able to get people to have that type of courage to say, I mean, what's wrong with you? Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Conversely, hey, how can I help?
Professor Hill, do we have to bring shame back to some respect in the, you know, in all communities, not just in the Black community? You got to turn your microphone on.
I don't think we have to bring shame back. What I think what we have to do is bring back an objective sense of right or wrong. I think our universities and our K-12, which have become national security threats, have been breeding ground and indoctrination centers for something called cultural relativism, where a kind of permissiveness that there is no such thing as right or wrong. What adjudicates truth claims are your feelings. And I want to elevate my high school opinion and my sophomoric high school opinion to the level of knowledge. And so my feelings constitute rightness, and therefore I'm right, has become an epidemic in our society. So I don't think it's really shaming. I think we need to get back to objective first principles, first of all, and to have a sense that there are objective criteria for adjudicating truth claims, that some things are right and some things are wrong. And we have gotten to a point where when a student in a classroom says, this is just my feelings, we have punished teachers now, especially with this ridiculous culturally responsive teaching and lead program initiated and ratified on February 17th by the Illinois School Board, that if a teacher tells a student you are wrong, she or he can get in trouble. It's cultural relativism that has run amok in our society that is leading a bunch of village idiots and leading students to become, you know, psychological weapons of mass destruction in our society.
But
that's the problem.
I want to go back to you, Willie, because you are you're sort of a known figure in Chicago because you've been on television quite a bit speaking out against the Chicago public school system, which is still closed to the most part for in-class teaching. Tell us a little bit what's happening with your children on the south side of Chicago, and what messages are you hearing from the school system and from school teacher unions about getting your kids back to school?
Well, what's happening with my children is, thankfully, we have collectively come together. When I say we, I'm talking about parents, to force the mayor to have a backbone and to open our schools up somewhat. So I got preschool that's going back. We have some of my elementary children that are going back. And we have high schoolers that still have no end in sight when they'll ever be able to come back. And the reason why, Bruce, that I fought so hard and continue to fight so hard for our schools to be open and simple. We have an achievement gap for Black children, and there's no way with my good conscience that I can sit down and advocate for children to not be properly educated in my community for political reasons, because we know what's the next result. These children, these teenagers are gonna be adults in the next year or two. They're gonna be unskilled, uneducated, and they're not going to be prepared to be able to take part in the greatest economy in the world, and through no fault of their own, but simply because teachers union have the mic. Mm-hmm. They have the mic right now to say that we're not going to open schools in major cities right now because they don't want to. And that's not okay. So we're fighting and we're winning, by the way.
Here's a question for everybody. Do school children around the United States who have not experienced in-classroom teaching in all 50 states, do they need a special course to be taught at an incoming college to bring them up to speed on all the things they may have lost or never been taught in the last 18 months? Anthony, yes. Starting with you.
I think unfortunately that may be the case, Bruce, because so much instruction has been lost over the last few months. I don't see how these guys ever catch up. And it's just recently that they've been going to school on an interim basis. And so, yes, absolutely. Something has to be done to get these guys up to speed, or else we've done a great disservice to the children of this country and to the children of the future.
Professor Hill, how realistic is it that such a remedial educational program would be implemented by any college on the receiving end of students from the last 18 months?
And not very realistic based on the colleges. Colleges are going to fight back. I think what's more realistic is to have students just simply repeat the year.
Okay.
And I know that parents are going to fight this, but, you know, this is quite common in other countries that are facing the pandemic, that have the students just repeat the year, especially if you're going to a public school. If you're rich enough to send your child to private school, I don't see why you can't pay to have them repeat the year. There are a lot of colleges that don't have remedial programs because they have to, in order to keep their upper tier staff status going, they don't have remedial programs. So I think it's more strategic to have students who are falling behind to simply repeat the year.
Willie, what do you think of that idea?
No, I reject it. And probably, I mean, if we could do a national universal policy, which I doubt we could, then perhaps, but we probably won't. And I think that we have to move in more in the direction of what you proposed, is bring the kids up, but, you know, have some type of remedial courses in recognition that, quite frankly, our children lost a year of instruction. I think that'd be more, because it's not just we also understand that education isn't simply what school building you enter,
right,
but it's also social development as well. And so what does an 18-year-old look like repeating high school? It may be tough, whereas as opposed to them going into college with some remedial courses to bring them up to speed, I think that would probably be more of a natural transition for them.
Anthony, I want to go back to something you talked about in the last segment, last couple of segments, and that is the extrication of men from many black homes, households, and that many years ago, it was a government policy and program that basically led to generations of black men leaving their homes because of a lack of incentive, or they were coerced out of their homes. My question to you is, because the out of wedlock rate is so high in the black and brown communities, and it's pretty high in the white communities as well, if you're 18 years old and you have fathered a child, okay, what incentive do you have to stay with that child, other than a moral responsibility, which is pretty hard to pin down? Are there things, as you say, government incentives? Are there government incentives that we should have to keep that unwed father in the home to help raise a child with the unwed mother? That's the question I want everybody to respond
no
to
government
and,
incentives.
And think about. Dave, thank you very much for
opinions
your question.
Opinions are everywhere when you watch
Thanks,
the
Bruce.
News. But what about your opinion? Why can't you just get the facts to decide for yourself? News Nation is on every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America, a nightly newscast in primetime that doesn't tell you what to think. Seven nights a week, News Nation will deliver you news, not talk. Facts, not opinions. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. It's your news, your nation.
Hope you enjoyed your meal. And I just want to say, he's lucky to have a brother like you.
Lucky? caring for my brother is far from easy. But he's a part of me, like my arms and legs, so I'll be his. No time for tired. Nothing can disable this love. He needs me, but I'm the lucky one, even though I need help now and then.
If you're caring for a loved one, visit aarp.org/caregiving for care guides and community. Support for your strength. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. And I can report to you, as I have been doing for the last couple of weeks, I finally got my COVID shot last Friday at the University of Chicago after a false start a couple of weeks ago. And I got the Pfizer shot, and everything went well. I was a little fatigued in the afternoon, but I had a nice long nap and no other side effects. So I'm waiting to get the next one in mid-March, but that's my COVID report to you. Before the break, I asked a question of our guests. Let me introduce them. Anthony Anderson is here. He is now retired, but he has spent much of the last 30 years in the criminal justice system as a guard within the juvenile courts and prisons and jails of Illinois. Willie Preston joins us. He is a community activist and very active in his local school council. He's become quite the media celebrity in the Chicagoland area, speaking up to try to get students back to school. And also, we have Dr. Jonah Hill, Professor Jonah Hill, Jason Hill, rather, I'm sorry. And he is author of a book called What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Depression. And he is a professor at DePaul University, where he told a story earlier in the program that because of his conservative beliefs, he is somewhat of an outlier, and they don't treat him very well at the school faculty lounge. So that's kind of a depressing. We've heard similar stories from Mike Miller, who is a frequent guest on this program from DePaul, and he's not told it from a first-person point of view, but again, being someone who works in the fields of academia, where you think everyone has got maybe above-average intellect, it's kind of sad to hear the story of someone being basically ostracized because of their political beliefs. Before the break, I proposed an idea, and I'm going to let you pick up on it, because it dealt right with what do we do? There's a huge issue of unwed mothers and unwed fathers in the United States. It has led to the systemic sort of breakdown of the black family. And my question is there some incentive, whether it is government or some foundation, is there any incentive that should be provided to a young father in that particular case to keep him with the unwed mother to begin a life together, with or without marriage? Let's say without marriage, because that brings up a moral issue that may be a little bit difficult to swallow. But is there any kind of incentive that could keep those two people together and begin a newly defined black family? Does that make any sense at all?
Not that I would like to incentivize bad or some would say irresponsible behavior.
Right.
But we're at that point now. So let's assume that we're at the point that now you have an 18-year-old man or woman who was now have a child out of wedlock or for whatever reason, and now he decides he wants to take care of his family. Normally, I'm against the idea that government should step in and do, you know, be this so-called father figure. But we have seen, and time has shown, that if that does not happen, then we know what will happen.
Right.
A lot of times what will happen is the father would no longer have any place in the child's life. A lot of times the person, the girl, will have nothing to do with the father. And so we start this vicious cycle.
And you're likely to see that child somewhere in the prison system, perhaps.
Right. And so what should happen, and not that the government per se has to take over the program or what have to incentivize this, but there has to be something in place to show this young couple that, hey, listen, now that you've brought a life into being, we feel that these are the best steps that you should take in this life and in this child's life. So we can have, so you guys can become, if not model citizens, but at least people that are going to be productive throughout their lifetime. And so, yes, there should be something set aside to show that, hey, listen, we realize and we understand that you may have made a decision that would be contrary to what, you know, you would normally do. And here's how we can help. And here's how society can help. And so under those circumstances and under these conditions that we find ourselves in, I am absolutely for some sort of intervention.
Yeah. And also there would be some time limit. It wouldn't be forever, but it might be for a couple of or 3 years. I want to go to Willie Preston. Respond to the same idea. Is it a good idea or is it a cockamamie idea?
No, I think a great idea. And I can tell you as a young father and have my peers, I starting families now and my brothers are, you know, one incredible policy that could really incentivize marriage would be at the tax code. If you had right now, that's a disincentive to be married through the tax code. If you were, if for instance, they have what they call the earned income tax credit, what it encourages is a parent to say that I'm the head of the household. And typically a lot of time, in most cases, that's the mom. And what it is you see this part of the year where families, especially low income families who qualify for this earned income tax credit, they're fighting each other over this lump sum of money that the government tenders in the form through tax. If we had an incentive for the earned income tax credit to be credited to couples who filed jointly, married and filed jointly, that could be a huge government incentive that we should explore and see if that would incentivize marriage. Another program that we could look at here in the city of Chicago. Why don't we have a program that says work for Earth? What I'm saying is if you have ex-offenders who have a large population of low-income Black communities, such as Auburn, Gresham, and Inglewood, where I live,
right?
Why don't we say to them, if you work for a year, we have $1 billion CHA budget, we'll give you an opportunity to become a homeowner. Because the pride in being a homeowner is something that is powerful in this country. And our people, our forefathers recognized that early on. It's called the American dream. It changes people's minds and attitudes. It builds community. Allow these men to work and don't have it so strictly attached to credit, because quite frankly, a lot of us are behind the eight ball in terms of finance and credit management, because quite frankly, the schools didn't teach it. Our parents were ignorant to it, and we are following suit behind them. By the time we figure it out, it's too late.
That's one of the biggest defaults or faults, I should say, of the public education system. You go through public education in this United States, you don't know anything about the economic system. You don't know anything about taxes. You don't know how to balance your checkbook. And again, your parents probably didn't know how to do it either. And again, it's just it's a vicious cycle. You wanted to ask me a question, and then I'm going to go to Professor Hill. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Rule a question in regards to the community. Do you see politicians within your own community pushing this nuclear family, pushing the two-parent family? Because I haven't seen that lately. What do you see?
Willie?
Is it to me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, well, no. Quite frankly, the answer is no. That's the short answer. No, I don't. I can expound, but no, that's the short.
Well, okay. One of the problems is you don't have, I mean, the Democratic Party certainly is not a cheerleader for intact families. It isn't.
No.
It isn't. And so there's one half of the political climate in the country is never going to go down the road that I've just suggested. And by the way, I don't think it has to be exclusively government. I mean, there are foundations that give billions of dollars to ideas that are just, you know, they're like laboratories. They're suggestions. But if they threw a couple of billion dollars or several billion dollars into an actual program that would basically help bootstrap a young unmarried mother and father, I mean, they would have to agree that they're going to stay together. I mean, this is not just for slam, bam, thank you, ma'am, and we're off. There has to be some kind of commitment there. Professor Hill, I want you to weigh in on my idea.
Well, I really agree with Willie. I mean, and I wouldn't just limit it to Blacks. I would limit it to poor whites as well.
Absolutely.
That is anyone who is 18 and is below the poverty line and earns a certain income should qualify for an earned income tax credit. I mean, I don't want to get the government to look. Government is the poison in the first place, and I don't want to, you don't create a cure by injecting more poison. So I think something like a tax, a vote tax credits for is a good way to go. I think a voucher for education is a way to go, to give these young couples an incentive to send their children to schools of their choice. If they want to start off by, I think a great way is to send your young child to a charter school and not to the public, the horrific public schools that exist in our country, which the government doesn't care about blacks.
But part of this program has to be more than just sending kids to a special school or charter school. It has to be about physically having a man and a woman who have fathered a child, nurtured and living in the same place, so that that child can see hopefully a loving relationship, maybe a little less stressful because of some financial incentive that's going there, so that those two people stay together, so their children, whether it's the, you know, the out of wedlock child or other children that may come their way, they don't end up and become guests of a juvenile justice jail somewhere in any state in the United States.
Well, look, I think one of the things that we could do it right now in the city of Chicago, there's an initiative that CPS has called Chicago Schools Initiative, and what it is basically trying to bring our neighborhood schools as the hub that they once were when I was a child, and certainly when my parents were children. And what we need to do is we need to use these spaces, these school buildings, as community hubs and encourage marriage and encourage other things. We need to have financial literacy for parents who have small children and have those programs inside of the school. We need to really have work programs inside of the school that encourage young black fathers to become tradesmen so that they can earn a real living. You know, it's one thing.
I agree with you 100%. Those schools, every community school should be open 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Back shortly from Chicago.
You should form your own opinions when you're presented facts without bias. That's what we call news. Every night at 7 p.m. on WGN America, news has a new primetime home, News Nation. Without all the talk and without an opinion, so you can make yours. It's not how it used to be. It's how it should be. News Nation, 7 nights a week on WGN America. Find your local channel by going to WGNAmerica.com. Because it's your news, your nation.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
Oh, what are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
What are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. It's been a long time since we've had an adventure in the forest.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
You're right. I should get out.
Yeah, the forest is not that far away.
Hey, Mom!
Come to the forest, where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. And we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Johnny listening to us on KTSM in El Paso, Texas. Johnny, how are you?
I'm fine.
How's the water and the power? Are you okay in your house?
I'm one of the people who was over on the west coast of Texas. And we were not touched by that at all. We was a part that wasn't in the grid.
Very good. Well, congratulations.
So nothing happened to us at all.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay. I called a few weeks ago urging you to take the shot, so I'm glad to hear you did it today. So welcome to the club, buddy, because I like you. I want you to be around a while, okay?
Okay.
So anyway, the reason I called is about the last segment. I know you moved on, but I get right to it.
Sure.
But I don't know what's going on in Chicago, so I didn't get all the information. But here in Texas, the teachers, I have a niece who's in her late 30s, and she has two kids, and she is the only breadwinner, so she has a problem not going back to work, too. But she swears, she and her other colleagues say they don't care what the union says, they don't care what anybody says. If they don't get a shot, they're not going back to school, period. That's the issue. They keep saying that the teachers need to be safe, but we're not hearing the word shot. That's what she tells us. Mm-hmm. So what's going on in Chicago?
Let me ask Willie. Willie, what is the latest with the shots for Chicago teachers? They all want it before they go back to school 5 days a week, but no one has agreed to that yet, have they?
No, they haven't, and I don't think that they should. And I think that I'll just make a small correction, Bruce, respectfully. All of them don't want it. Now, the union obviously speaks for all of their members, right, and the union has called for the shots. But we all know that there is a serious level of shot phobia. And that's very prevalent inside the Black community because of distrust in the of the health system in our country.
Right.
And so I've met a ton of teachers who simply don't want to take the shot. And so it is really what we hear a lot of is people saying they want the shot before they can go in, and now they don't want the shot. The goalpost is constantly being moved. So what happened is the mayor did acquiesce and go further with the union and said they'll give greater testing. They'll do more tests per week. They set up hubs of testing sites exclusively for teachers, which is a good thing, and I don't oppose it. I want to make certain that the teachers are safe. We want to make certain that our children's future futures are safe. And I'm sitting at home and barely logged into computers, or even if they are logged in full time, that's not going to work. The kids are falling behind. They're going to have lost skills. And a lot of our teachers, they're aware of what's happening in those classes and what's not happening. And what's not happening is a lot of our children are matriculating properly.
Yeah. Well, again, go ahead, Johnny, back to you. Any final word you want to say?
No, I'm just saying I didn't know that there were teachers out there who didn't want to take the shot. And I know about people in the Black community feel that way. Matter of fact, I have some relatives in Chicago now. I've been trying to twist their arms to get them to do it. And they keep talking about the Tuskegee Institute, the Tuskegee experiment. I try to tell them, in the Tuskegee situation, it wasn't that they gave Black people shots. They wouldn't give them shots. That's why. That's what it was all about. So they're confused. I tell them to read up on their history.
Well,
there was also some discussion from our the mayor was floated out that getting the shots would be a mandate for teachers to return into the classroom, and then our teacher union pushed back against that. So they say they want the shots before they return to the class, and then in the next breath they say, well, we don't want it to be mandated for us to come back into class. So it's all confusing, which is why we need to make certain that the mayor has a firm position and that they follow the science. The CDC has said that we can safely open our schools without shots. They were very clear, and this is why I believe myself and many others in Chicago are fighting for our schools to be open by following the science.
Well, also, it seems to me that we should look to the president who has said that he wants to follow the science. But in this particular case, he's not following the science, Anthony.
Well, you know, I just think that the Kentucky governor, Andy Beshear, who has prioritized teachers to great controversy and has vaccinated the majority. I think there are just about three districts that have not been mandated, because what's not being discussed is that, you know, the suicide rates among our young people are going up. The mental health crisis among these young students. I mean, I as a college professor face this in the classroom, where the depression rate is unprecedented. It's crazy. So, I mean, the teachers unions, I mean, I have a particular view about teachers union. They should all be abolished and done away with. They're the worst things that you could inflict on young children today. But I think the governor of the state of Illinois needs to follow in the footsteps of Governor Andy Beshear and prioritize teachers and have them vaccinated and have them return to the classroom and have our kids return to school full time.
I think personally, in hindsight, most of these governors and most of these mayors, if they're looking at the school situation as it is now today, I think they would have probably had a different course of action as it relates to opening up these schools. The schools, the mayors want to open up the schools, but then there's way too much pushback from the unions. And as long as the unions are in charge, you're going to have this situation where we have here where everybody's doing a double talk. And so for the most part, I believe most of the mayors want the schools to be open. But they have made it almost impossible because of the positions that they've taken in the past to reopen those schools.
That's right. And also, they built their cases.
I don't think that is fair, and I don't think it's wise. I think that if to prioritize the teachers over all other citizens and all of our other workforce, is dangerous and short-sighted in my judgment. What about the low-income people that have worked throughout the entire pandemic? They're not immune. These are the people that I have to interface with or have to.
Willie, we're running out of time. I want to thank first of all Johnny in El Paso for calling in. Thank you very much. And Anthony Anderson, thank you very much. Always good to have you back on the program. Jason Hill, author of the book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Radical Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. That's the book. Thanks very much for joining us, Professor. And Willie Preston, community activist, Facebook friend. Willie, you got a nice response when you told people you were going to be on Beyond the Beltway. I think you did a nice job tonight. We look forward to having you on again. Our thanks to Connor McKnight for his assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Evanston, Illinois.
What is hope? Hope to me was just that he would get to come home. I had no idea how hard it would be once he got back.
I wish she'd stop drinking so much. She thinks it's helping, but it's not. I hope she sees that soon.
I act like I don't care if he comes to my games. But I hope he does.
I used to hope he'd find happiness again. Now I hope our marriage makes it.
I hope Grandpa will get help. He thinks it's too late, but it's not.
With everything that he's going through, I hope he sees a counselor. I just want my brother back.
I hoped he'd get help. Stop hoping things would get better on their own. He told me to stop asking. I didn't. Then one day he asked for a ride.
Hope is knowing there are other families just like yours, that the veterans they love got help and recovered. Go to maketheconnection.net and turn hope into action.
Matt always knew he wanted to be a doctor. That's why he makes the most of every day. To study before breakfast. To work hard. To do whatever was necessary to achieve his goal. He found an answer in the military. If you have a passion, a vision for your future in any field, todaysmilitary.com can be your path to a fulfilling career. You have a calling. We have an answer. Find your way at todaysmilitary.com.
My name is Bobby. I'm a veteran and lost my leg to a roadside bomb. My victory was going from a wheelchair to becoming a weightlifting champion.
I'm Sam. I'm a veteran. My victory was finding a career I can be proud of and supporting my family.
America's veterans are on their most important tour, the tour of their lives.
I'm a veteran. My victory was going from homeless to home.
At DAV, we're on a mission to help veterans get the benefits they've earned.
I'm a veteran, and my victory was finishing my education.
DAV offers veterans of all generations a lifetime of support for victories great and small.
My victory was proving that disability is not a limitation.
My victory was getting my service dog a new best friend.
We help more than a million veterans every year as they face and conquer their challenges.
My victory is being able to be there for my family.
When America's veterans win, we all win. Help us support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
Standing up for what's right. Helping out when things go wrong. Seeking the truth and speaking our minds. Not just making records, but breaking them. Leading the way behind the camera, beyond the runway, and on the silver screen. Not just making our mark, but making a difference. Now that's a job for a Girl Scout. Girl Scouts, preparing girls for a lifetime of leadership.